You're listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and I'm your host. Welcome, dear ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Welcome, dear kinsmen, kinswomen. I did it the other way this time. There's so much that we're learning at this point. I know you must be learning just as much as I am. And it's so exciting to be able to find out what's really going on and find out what happened to Christianity. I'm not going to go into the Apostle Paul right now. I'm going to go into another sellout. But we're also going to continue with Fritz Springmeier's book. I just happened to find out a brother wrote me and he said, I think Alfred Hitchcock got his start filming at the concentration camps at the end of the war. And he said, I don't know, remember where I read this, but I'm pretty sure that's true. Something like that. That's what he said to me. So I went to Wikipedia and looked up Alfred Hitchcock. And there's a lot here, I think, that it's worth reading this together. This is somebody that comes off to be a mild-mannered man and harmless. But he's an antichrist, for sure. Guaranteed. And a brother, a good brother named Doug, was watching all of his shows, and he decided, I don't like this guy. You know what I mean? And I had not realized, you know, just how anti-Christian this guy really is. He was at a football game, he does these little monologues at the beginning of the show. He was at a football game. I can't go into the whole thing for you, but it was the Lions. He was rooting for the Lions. And in other words, the Christians were being killed. It really wasn't a football game after all. They were just dressed as college students and having the little flags and everything. And he was rooting for the Lions. That's just one example. I told you last week about how Alfred Hitchcock had shows where, you know, that always show Christians in a bad light and white people in general. Even though a lot of these people are Jews that play the parts, this is what I was talking about. They love to be able to play the white man. They want to be us so badly that they love to be actors so that they can pretend that they're the white man and they can denigrate us, you know, by having us do all kinds of evil things. I think a lot of the reasons why the Jews played these actors and all these things were because they were anti-Christian and anti-white. And I don't think white people wanted to even bother with something like that. You know, why do that to your own race? Maybe some did just to, because plenty of our people are sellouts. But they don't want to give our people the money. So, of course, they want to pay anyone that has Jewish connections for music, for the arts in general, for talking news heads from back in Boston. The whole team of meteorologists, which is one of the easiest jobs in the world, were all Jews. And it's just amazing, but neither here nor there. Mr. Alfred Hitchcock, but listen to this first, because now this should tick you off. It should give you a real understanding of who this guy really is. Sir Alfred Joseph Hitchcock. Sir. He's a Freemason. But as I just started looking at this, right as I was setting it up to read it for the show, I noticed the peculiar numbers this fellow has. Listen to this. He's born on the 13th of August. August is the 8th month, right? Right? The 13th of August, 1899. That's either three nines or it's 666666. And then he died on the 29th of April. You see, 1980. and 2-9 is 11. So it's kind of interesting that he has these funny numbers already. So it says he was an English film director and producer. He's one of the most influential and extensively studied filmmakers in the history of cinema. Known as the master of the master, another one they're calling the master. The master of suspense. He directed over 50 feature films in a career spanning 6 decades, becoming as well known as any of his actors thanks to his many interviews, his cameo roles in most of his films, and his hosting and producing of the television anthology Alfred Hitchcock Presents 1955 to 1965. His films garner a total of 46 Oscar nominations and 6 wins. Okay. This man, you'll see why he has all these things. You'll see why he was allowed to work in the arena, let's say. Let's call it the arena. Because he certainly does root for the lions to kill the Christians. Born in Leytonstone, Essex, Hitchcock entered the film industry in 1919. How do you like that for a number? As a title card designer after training as a technical clerk and copywriter for a telegraph cable company, he made his directorial debut with the silent film The Pleasure Garden in 1925, his first successful film The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog, The Lodger, Freemasonry, 1927, helped to shape the thriller genre. While his 1929 film Blackmail was the first British talkie, two of his 1930 thrillers, The 39 Steps, 13 times 3, 3 times 9 is 27, 2 and 7 is 9, 1935, and The Lady Vanishes, 1938. That's 9-11 put right in there, you see. 1 times 9 is 9 and 3 and 8 is 11. Are ranked among the greatest British films of the 20th century. By 1939, Hitchcock was a filmmaker of international importance. And film producer David O. Selznick, you know what kind of a name that is, don't you? Persuaded him to move to Hollywood. A string of successful films followed, including Rebecca, 1940, Foreign Correspondent, 1940, Suspicion, 41, Shadow of a Doubt, 43, and Notorious, 46. Rebecca won the Academy Award for Best Picture, although Hitchcock himself was only nominated as Best Director. He was also nominated for Lifeboat, 1944, and Spellbound, 1945. Spellbound. Although he never won the Best Director Academy Award. The Hitchcockian style includes the use of camera movement to minimize a person's gaze, thereby turning viewers into voyeurs, and framing shots to maximize anxiety and fear. The film critic Robin Wood wrote that the meaning of a Hitchcock film is there in the method, in the progression from shot to shot. A Hitchcock film is an organism with the whole implied, that's the W-H-O-L-E, implied in every detail, and every detail related to the whole. After a brief lull of commercial success in the late 40s, Hitchcock returned to form with Strangers on a Train. That was quite a movie. I remember that one. Dial M for Murder, 1954. By 1960, Hitchcock had directed 4 films, often ranked among the greatest of all time, Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, 1959, and Psycho, 1960, with the first and last of these garnering him Best Director nominations. In 2012, Vertigo replaced Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, 1941, as the British Film Institute's greatest film ever made, based on its worldwide poll of hundreds of film critics. By 2018, 8 of his films had been selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry, including his personal favorite, Shadow of a Doubt, 1943. He received a BAFTA fellowship in 1971, the AFI Life Achievement Award in 1979 and was knighted in December that year, 4 months before he died. Okay, let's go down here. Biography. Early childhood and education. Hitchcock was born on the 13th of August, 1899, in a flat above his parents' leased grocer shop at 517 High Road, Leytonstone, on the outskirts of East London, then part of Essex. The youngest of three children, William Daniel, Ellen Kathleen, and Alfred Joseph. His parents, Emma Jane Hitchcock, Nee Whalen, and William Edgar Hitchcock, were both Roman Catholics. With partial roots in Ireland, William was a greengrocer, as his father had been. There was a large extended family, including Uncle John Hitchcock with his five-bedroom Victorian house on Campion Road, Putney, complete with maid, cook, chauffeur, and gardener. Every summer, John rented a seaside house for the family in Cliftonville, Kent. Hitchcock said that he first became class conscious there, noticing the differences between the tourists and locals. Describing himself as a well-behaved boy, his father called him, listen to this, his little lamb without a spot, quote unquote. Hitchcock said he could not remember ever having had a playmate. One of his favorite stories for interviewers was about his father sending him to a local police station with a note when he was five. The policeman looked at the note and locked him in a cell for a few minutes, saying, "This is what we do to naughty boys." The experience left him, he said, with a lifelong fear of policemen. In 1973, he told Tom Snyder that he was scared stiff of anything to do with the law and wouldn't even drive a car in case he got a parking ticket. Sounds like a cuckoo to me. I mean, the cuckoo clock's there, but I don't know if there's a bird inside. Unbelievable. Okay. When he was six, the family moved to Limehouse and leased two stories at 130 and 175 Salmon Lane, where they ran as a fish and chip shop and fishmongers, respectively. They lived above the former. It seems that Hitchcock was seven when he attended his first school, the Horwath House Convent in Poplar, which he entered in 1907. According to Patrick McGilligan, he stayed at the Horwath House for at most 2 years. He also attended a convent school, the Woad Street School, for daughters and gentlemen and little boys, run by the Faithful Companions of Jesus. Briefly attending a primary school near his home, and was for a very short time when he was nine, a boarder at Salesian College in Battersea. The family moved when he was 11, this time to Stepney, and on 5th October 1910, Hitchcock was sent to St. Ignatius College in Stamford Hill, Trottenham, now in the London borough of Haringey. Listen to this now. A Jesuit grammar school with a reputation for discipline. He went to a Jesuit school. What do we know about the Jesuits? Let's continue. The priest used a hard rubber cane on the boys, always at the end of the day, so the boys had to sit through classes anticipating the punishment once they knew they'd been written up for it. He said it was here that he developed his sense of fear. The school register lists his year of birth as 1900 rather than 1899. Spotto writes that it seems that he was deliberately enrolled as a 10-year-old, perhaps because he was a year behind with his schooling, while biographer Jean Adair reports that Hitchcock was an average or slightly above average pupil. Hitchcock said he was usually among the four or five at the top of the class. Mm-hmm. At the end of his first year, his work in Latin, English, French, and religious education was noted. His favorite subject was geography, and he became interested in maps and railway and bus timetables. According to Taylor, he could recite all the stops on the Orient Express. He told Peter Bogdanovich, listen to this, the Jesuits taught me organization, control, and to some degree, analysis. Hitchcock told his parents that he wanted to be an engineer. And on 25th July 1913, he left St. Ignatius and enrolled in night classes at the London Country Council School of Engineering and Navigation in Poplar. In a book-length interview in 1962, he told François Truffaut that he had studied mechanics, electricity, acoustics, and navigation. Then on 12th December 1914, his father, who had been suffering from emphysema and kidney disease, died at the age of 52. To support himself and his mother, his older siblings had left home by then, Hitchcock took a job for 15 shillings a week, L71 in 2017. As a technical clerk at the Henley Telegraph and Cable Company in Blomfield Street near London Wall. Funny, it's Blomfield. It usually would be Bloomfield, but it says Blomfield, so that's it. He kept up his night classes, this time in art, history, painting, economics, and political science. His older brother ran the family shops while he and his mother continued to live in Salmon Lane. Hitchcock was too young to enlist in the First World War when the First World War broke out in 1914, July. And when he reached the required age of 18 in 1917, he received a C3 classification, free from serious organic disease, able to stand service conditions in garrisons at home, and only suitable for sedentary work. He joined a cadet regiment of the Royal Engineers and took part in the theoretical briefings, weekend drills, and exercises. John Russell Taylor wrote that, in one session of practical exercises in Hyde Park, Hitchcock was required to wear puttees. He could never master wrapping them around his legs, and they repeatedly fell down around his ankles. After the war, Hitchcock began dabbling in creative writing. In June 1919, he became a founding editor and business manager of Henley's in-house publication, the Henley Telegraph, six pence a copy, to which he submitted several short stories. Henley's promoted him to the advertising department, where he wrote copy and drew graphics for advertisements for electric cable. He apparently loved the job and would stay late at the office to examine the proofs. He told Truffaut that this was his first step towards cinema. He enjoyed watching films, especially American cinema, and from the age of 16, read the trade papers. He watched Charlie Chaplin, D.W. Griffith, and Buster Keaton, and particularly liked Fritz Lang's Der Mude Todd, 1921. A lot of Jews there. Interwar career, 1919 to 1939. While still at Henley's, he read in a trade paper that famous players Lasky, the production arm of Paramount Pictures, was opening a studio in London. They were planning to film The Sorrows of Satan by Marie Corelli. So he produced some drawings for the title cards and sent his work to the studio. They hired him, and in 1919, he began working for Islington Studios in Poole Street, Hoxton, as a title card designer. Donald Spoto writes that most of his staff were Americans with strict job specifications, but the English workers were encouraged to try their hand at anything, which meant that Hitchcock gained experience as a co-writer, art director, and production manager on at least 18 films. There's that number again. The Times wrote in February 1922 about the studio's special art title department under the supervision of Mr. A.J. Hitchcock. His work there included number 13, also known as Mrs. Peabody, canceled because of financial problems. The few finished scenes are lost. And Always Tell Your Wife, 1923, which he and Seymour Hicks finished together when Hicks was about to give up on it. Hicks wrote later about being helped by a fat youth who was in charge of the property room, none other than Alfred Hitchcock. When Paramount pulled out of London in 1922, Hitchcock was hired as an assistant director by a new firm run in the same location by Michael Balcon, later known as Gainsborough Pictures. Hitchcock worked on Woman to Woman in 1923 with the director, Graham Cutts, designing the set, writing the script, and producing. He said, "It was the first film that I had really got my hands onto. The editor and script girl on Woman to Woman was Alma Reveal, his future wife." He also worked as an assistant to Cutts on The White Shadow, 1924, The Passionate Adventure, 1924, The Blackguard, 1925, and The Prude's Fall, 1925. The Blackguard was produced at the Babelsberg Studios in Potsdam, where Hitchcock watched part of the making of F.W. Murnau's film The Last Laugh in 1924. He was impressed with Murnau's work and later used many of his techniques for the set to design his own productions. In the summer of 1925, Balcon asked Hitchcock to direct The Pleasure Garden, 1925, starring Virginia Valli, a co-production of Gainsborough and the German firm Amelka at the Geiselgastig studio near Munich. Reveal, by then Hitchcock's fiancée, was assistant director-editor. Although the film was a commercial flop, Balcon liked Hitchcock's work. A Daily Express headline called him the young man with a mastermind. Balcon asked him to direct a second film in Munich, The Mountain Eagle, 1926, based on the original story titled Fear O God. The film is lost. Hitchcock called it a very bad movie. Hitchcock's luck changed with his first thriller, The Lodger, A Story of London Fog, 1927, about the hunt for a serial killer wearing a black cloak and carrying a bag is murdering young blonde woman in London. Jeez, that's a vampire murdering blonde women in London. And who else might that be? No matter who it is, it's a Jew murdering blonde women. So this is only on Tuesdays he would murder them. A landlady suspects that her lodger is the killer, but he turns out to be innocent. To convey the impression footsteps were being heard from an upper floor, Hitchcock had a glass floor made so that the audience could see the lodger pacing up and down in his room above the landlady. Hitchcock had wanted the leading man to be guilty, or for the film at least to end ambiguously, but the star was Ivor Novello, a matinee idol, and the star system, quote-unquote, meant that Novello could not be the villain. Hitchcock told Truffaut, you have to clearly spell it out in big letters. He is innocent, quote-unquote. He had the same problem years later with Cary Grant in Suspicion, 1941. Released in January 27, The Lodger was a commercial and critical success in the UK. Hitchcock told Truffaut that the film was the first of his to be influenced by the expressionist techniques he had witnessed in Germany. In truth, you might almost say that The Lodger was my first picture. He made the first cameo appearance in the film because an extra was needed and was depicted sitting in the newsroom. A second appearance standing in a crowd as the leading man is arrested is in doubt. On December 2, 1926, Hitchcock married the English-American screenwriter Alma Reveal, 1899-1982, at the Brompton Oratory in South Kensington. The couple honeymooned in Paris, Lake Como, and St. Moritz before returning to London to live in a leased flat on top of two floors of 153 Cromwell Road, Kensington. Reville, who was born just hours after Hitchcock, converted from Protestantism to Catholicism, apparently at the insistence of Hitchcock's mother. She was baptized on the 31st of May, 1927. There's that again. And confirmed at Westminster Cathedral by Cardinal Francis Bourne on 5th of June. In 1928, they learned that she was pregnant. The Hitchcocks purchased Winter Grace, a Tudor farmhouse set in 11 acres on Stroud Lane, Shamley Green, Surrey, for about $2,500. Their daughter and only child, Patricia Alma Hitchcock, was born on 7th July that year. Reville became her husband's closest collaborator. Charles Champlin wrote in 1982, "The Hitchcock touch had four hands, and two were Alma's." When Hitchcock accepted the AFI Life Achievement Award in 79, he said he wanted to mention four people who had given me the most affection, appreciation, and encouragement, and constant collaboration. The first of the four is a film editor, the second is a scriptwriter, the third is the mother of my daughter, Pat, and the fourth is a fine cook as ever has performed miracles in a domestic kitchen. And their names are Alma Reville. Reville wrote or co-wrote on many of Hitchcock's films, including Shadow of a Doubt, Suspicion, and The 39 Steps. Early sound films. I mean, this is, you know, this could take the whole show here. I mean, we're into it, but I mean, this goes on and on and on and on. And I'm going to go right to this port here. If you want to read this, you can certainly look it up on Wikipedia. But now we're going to go to wartime nonfiction films. Hitchcock returned to the UK for an extended visit in late 1943 and early 1944. While there, he made two short, listen, propaganda films, Bon Voyage 1944 and Adventure Malgache 1944 for the Ministry of Information. In June and July 1945, Hitchcock served as treatment advisor, quote unquote, on a Holocaust documentary that used Allied forces footage of the Liberian of the liberation of the Nazi concentration camps. The film was assembled in London and produced by Sidney Bernstein of the Ministry of Information. Doesn't it sound like George Orwell to you? 1984? Who brought Hitchcock, a friend of his, so obviously Hitchcock is friends with Jews. Right? The film was assembled in London and produced by Sidney Bernstein of the Ministry of Information, who brought Hitchcock, a friend of his, on board. It was originally intended to be broadcast to the Germans, in other words, to brainwash them. But the British government deemed it too traumatic to be shown to a shocked post-war population. Instead, it was transferred in 1952 from the British War Office Films Vault to London's Imperial War Museum and remained unreleased until 1985, when an edited version was broadcast as an episode of PBS Frontline under the title Imperial War Museum Had Given It, Memory of the Camps. The full-length version of the film, German Concentration Camps Factual Survey, was restored in 2014 by scholars at the Imperial War Museum. Let me say this. This is a quote from Hitchcock, 1967. He said, "I felt the need to make a little contribution to the war effort, and I was both overweight and overage for military service. I knew that if I did nothing, I'd regret it for the rest of my life." Yeah. Read into that what you may say. So it says later Selznick films. This is post-war Hollywood years, 1945 to 53. Hitchcock worked for, you see, what I read into that is that he may have been told, either you do this for me by Bernstein, or that's it for your movie making career. Because you see, it exploded after that. Hitchcock worked for David Selznick again when he directed Spellbound 1945. Hello? Which explores psychoanalysis and features of a dream sequence designed by Salvador Dali. The dream sequence, as it appears in the film, is 10 minutes shorter than it was originally envisioned. Selznick edited it to make it play more effectively. Gregory Peck plays amnesiac Dr. Anthony Edwards under the treatment of the analyst Dr. Peterson, by Ingrid Bergman, who falls in love with him while trying to unlock his repressed past. You see, it's a promotion of Sigmund Freud's nonsense. You see? Two point of view shots were achieved by building a large wooden hand, which would appear to belong to the character whose point of view the camera took, and outsized props for it to hold. A bucket-sized glass of milk and a large wooden gun for added novelty and impact. And the climatic gunshot was hand-colored red on some copies of the black and white film. The original musical score by Miklos Rosa makes use of the theremin, and some of it was later adapted by the composer into Rosa's piano concerto. Opera 31, 1967, for piano and orchestra. Well, I also play the theremin. Francois Truffaut, Hitchcock told him that Selznick had sold him Ingrid Bergman, Cary Grant, and the screenplay by Ben Hecht to RKO Radio Pictures as a package for $500,000. The equivalent of $6,555,461 in 2019. Because of the cost of overruns on Selznick's Duel in the Sun, 1946, notorious stars Bergman and Grant, both Hitchcock regulars, and features a plot about Nazis, uranium in South America, his prescient use of uranium as a plot device led him to being briefly placed under surveillance by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. According to McGilligan, in or around March 1945, Hitchcock and Ben Hecht consulted Robert Millikan of the California Institute of Technology about the development of a uranium bomb. Selznick complained that the notion was science fiction, quote-unquote, only to be confronted by the news of the detonation of two atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan in August 1945. So I think that's about all I want you to know. So we know that he is very close to Jews. We've seen that. We've seen that Jews propelled him in his career. We see that he worked for Jews by making two propaganda films at the end of the war against Germany. And then we have the accounts of all of his movies, which I like Alfred Hitchcock's movies and all that kind of stuff, but when you really look at it for what it is, you realize that it's anti-Christian. So do I really like them? I don't know. I might turn against it, of course. You see, these traitors, they sell out to these Jews. Now, I don't know what, I know the name Hitchcock is one of the big families in the Jewluminati. We've seen that in Fritz Springmeier's book. Obviously, the fellow had money. I mean, he didn't come from a rich family, but then again, he had a rich uncle or whatever he was. But obviously, this dirty little man who looks harmless, and that's the whole idea about it all, he's rooting for the lions against the Christians. And that's all you really need to know. It's amazing to me what people will do for to be king for a day. King for a day is not worth it. Selling your soul out to be famous in a world like this is not worth it. You're not going to be famous. You might get a little temporary attention and so on and so forth, but in the long run, you're nobody. You're forgotten. You sold your soul, you're gone. Is it really worth it? Like I say, when I see Jimmy Page and all these people, that's something I'm glad I mentioned that, because in William G. Finley's his expose of the Apostle Paul, I'll see if I can quickly drum this up. He talks about the word sozo, and it's a meaning in the scriptures. I'll see if we can, I think this is it right here. Yes, this is it. Now, you know that on Jimmy Page's uniform that he wears when he was doing his concerts, he had the word zozo. This is sozo, like it's a reversal. This is just a proposal of what might be possible here. Now, the word sozo in Hebrew, they just keep on putting things in front of me here, man. Okay, so they wanted me to take my ad blocker off. So anyway, sozo. Now, it means to save, to keep safe and sound, to rescue from danger or destruction, one from injury or peril, to save a suffering one from perishing, suffering from disease, to make well, to heal, to restore health, to preserve one who is in danger of destruction, to save or rescue, to save in the technical biblical sense. Now, my proposal is this. Zoso means the opposite of to save from suffering. It means to destroy. And when Robert Plant, I've mentioned this before, when Robert Plant released the dove into the audience, the world, people look at the dove as a sign of peace, but to them it means the total opposite. It means destruction. So you must realize the ramifications. And this is telling, I'm telling you that I believe that this is exactly what Zoso is. Now, he probably got this from Crowley, who we have recently found out from Fritz Springmeier that Crowley is of Jewish heritage. Geez, what a surprise that is. The 666 number, the beast, is of Jewish heritage. Oh, I'm just so surprised. How could that be? And so I thought that that was interesting. I honed in on it right away when I saw the thing sozo, and, you know, when you reverse it, zoso, you see? And I do believe that that's what it means. If you look up what zoso means, I don't think you'll find out what it means. Of course, they don't want you to know. So that's just a little tidbit for you, and make of it what you will. So these are the kinds of things I'm thinking about. Let me mention this about the Apostle Paul, even though we're not doing an Apostle Paul. I'll mention it deliberately on the next Apostle Paul show, but I can't resist this one because it was given to me last night. When Moses went to see the Father, when he came down from the mountain, he had a hood on because he was glowing. Now, when the disciples met Jesus as a man after his resurrection, he was not glowing, and there was no mention of that I can remember anyway. I definitely don't believe that he was glowing. So, here's what I'm telling you. If the Apostle Paul, if that was Jesus on the road to Damascus, which it wasn't, I really do not believe so, it was the light bringer. Paul would have been glowing. And the people with him would have been as well. You see what I'm saying? Now make of it what you will. But see, this wasn't Jesus as a man, supposedly. This was Jesus as a light. And then yet Paul tells you that the devil can disguise himself as an angel of light. You see, it's all there for you to perceive. There's no mention of the Apostle Paul and the people that were with him glowing. See, this was a light. And so that light would have given its emanation onto the Apostle Paul and the people with him. Like Moses had that same kind of light transference. See, that's the Shekinah glory I'm talking about. That's why the Father will light the kingdom. He emanates light himself. And those around him obviously take up that light. We will be restored that light because we are his offspring. So therefore, light will be all around us. If you understand what I'm saying. These are all things that, you know, I took time to think last night, and things like that just come out. You know, it's amazing. I said, wow, I never really thought of it that way. But that makes sense. There's just too many things that are wrong here with this Apostle Paul thing. And too many things line up with the Judaization and the destruction of Christianity and the Apostle Paul's gospel. That's all I'll say about that. Let's listen to a song and take a break. Then we'll come back to Fritz Springmeier. I think you'll enjoy this song. This is back in a time, this was from my Look to the Daysman album, and I was very influenced by the Beach Boys and Yes. I was doing a lot of singing with the Beach Boys and Yes, and so I would sing in the lower, mid, and higher registers. So, of course, it influenced me to do some singing like that. And I think you'll like this. This is about Michael, the Archangel.
Stay. They've all been cast down. dragon and all of his angels would cast to the earth on that day.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Saxon's Creed Radio Show, brought to you by DavidJamesBoston.com, your source for the truth. Well, I figured my English brothers and sisters would love to hear about that Alfred Hitchcock thing because they know those places I was speaking about, and I'm sure they enjoyed the little background information that was there. I'm sure many of them have been to those places, or some of them anyway. Okay, we're in Fritz Springmeier's book, and we're on page 131, chapter 1.3, Progressive Light. Progressive Light. In this chapter, you will learn how the world order, or the Jews' world order, gets instant power bases by creating Gnostic religions. You will learn how to build a Gnostic religion. You will be shown information that contrasts Gnosticism with Christ's teachings. Already, we're already on the starting this stuff. Are you ready? The young SS officer was only 23, but perhaps the most talented in Germany for the Indiana Jones role he was cast into. His quest was a real-life search for the sacred cup, the lost key to the ancient Germanic legends, known to the Christian world as the Holy Grail. This tall, muscular, and handsome German had studied the Grail legends in detail. He even knew the local dialect. It was 1931 in southern France. The new Nazi religion needed the Grail to legitimize their new Gnostic religion. I don't really believe this, but okay, we'll take it for what it's worth, which was based on the ancient German Gnosticism of the German tribes. His name was Otto Rahm, like Rahm Emanuel. Like many SS officers, he would commit suicide before the Allies could capture him. Otto Rahm on his mission in the grottos of Ornolac. Otto Rahm may have succeeded in his quest. Apparently, a German castle was restored with slave labor for the Grail. But like the Nazi religion, the Grail has remained a well-kept secret for many years. Strange, yes. But even more so, in the cover-up of the Nazis' Gnostic religion, one of the first items done at the Nuremberg trials was to forbid the mention of the Nazi religion. It was inadmissible. One of the best-kept secrets of the 20th century is the occultic roots and the nature of the religious philosophy at the heart of the Third Reich. Because of the disinformation about the Nazis, the public is unable to grasp the connections of Nazism with the modern-day New Age movement and Masonic lodges. You know, he's going to talk about, you know, I'm sure the Thule Society will be, you know, mentioned. But here's something that you should know, that you should remember. See, not everything here I would agree with, but who knows? I don't know what really, I wasn't there. I can't say what goes on. I agree with my woman friend that told me that Hitler stole the identity of the German people, and I agree with that. I definitely think that that is a wise observance of the real true situation. However, let me mention that when Hitler took over, you know, when he first came into Germany to power, one of the first things he did was get rid of the Freemasons. So I don't know. You know, I remember that, you know, they've talked about him having Madame Blavatsky's book on the side of his table, and that the, you know, they try to say the SS is a satanic organization. And yet, if you go to my website and look up SS, you'll see a document from the SS that was translated from the German. And it's very Christian and very non-satanic. So they do want to demonize Germany and Germans. There's no doubt about it. And the Father will let us know, and, you know, we'll finally find out about Hitler and all the things that we want to know about when the Father lets us know about them. Until then, there's been so many demonizations and so many things that have gone on here that how can one really know? You know, what I've learned from talking to people overseas is that we in America really don't know about the people like Viktor Orban or these different people. I found out recently about Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He's not what you think he is. He's not a good fellow. Let's just put it that way. And the only thing I had known about this fellow was that he suffered in the gulag camps and wrote books about it. That's all I knew about him. But he was part of the army. I can't go into all that now, but you see, there's a lot of things in America that we don't know about people that are leaders in Europe and so on and so forth. There's a lot to know in this world. That's why I always tell you, I don't know everything. I know a lot of things, and I know a little about a lot of things and about a few things, you know, and I just do the best I can, but I don't know everything. I think that anybody that thinks they know everything is so deceived, because there's just too much to know. One cannot know everything. One just does the best they can to get to the bottom of everything and get to the truth. So the Father puts people in our lives to help us to find things out. It says Nazism, the Masons, and World War II. World War II was staged. The Allies were led by three Masons, Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill. And as we saw yesterday in the book, we know that Roosevelt is Jewish, when we know that Churchill is Jewish, and the Catholics called them the Jew Stalin. So we know that they're not only three Masons, but they're three Jews, which is not mentioned here. The Germans were led by men who were from an offshoot of the Masons. Tu Duce in Italy had also been associated with the occult and Masons, but like Hitler had broken away and gone in the direction of fascism, Stalin encouraged Hitler to strike the West, knowing that Hitler wouldn't attack. Stalin made a pact with Hitler so that Hitler could rest assured that his rear would be safe. There is a book which goes into detail about the machinations that Stalin went through to get Hitler to attack Poland. Roosevelt knew that the Pearl Harbor attack was coming. Let me stop right there. Now listen, you know that I've already talked about, it wasn't Stalin, it was the Churchill fellow. He was paid $2 million by a Jewish Freemason to keep on drumming up the war on, you know, go to war with Germany, got to go to war. And he definitely wrote Poland, I don't know what they were called at the time. They were given that land after World War I, and this was Danzig and a lot of the German territories. And what Churchill wanted them to do is keep on prodding Hitler, keep on harming the German people over there, until finally Hitler went to war. See, you can only prod an animal so long until it attacks back. And the funny thing I mentioned about this is that Churchill promised Poland that when Germany attacked, they would take care of them. Guess what happened? They didn't take care of them. So much for the Allies, so much for the Freemasonic Jews. See, the Allies were the evil part of the war in reality. They called the other part the Axis, right? But you see, the Allies were the evil. You know, it's hard to see your own country as the bad guys. But it's not really your own country. It's who's inhabiting your country. The Jews and Freemasons. So Roosevelt knew that the Pearl Harbor attack was coming. Roosevelt, got to get down to the next page, was looking for a way to get the U.S. into the war. The war was costly to the world in general. But looking at it from the viewpoint of the One World Conspiracy, it was brilliant. They were able to profit greatly. They, see, he doesn't say who they are. It's the Jews. Russia was able to conquer half of Europe. They were able to use the threat of Russia to create a de facto united Europe. The U.S. was able to use the World War II to allow a massive exchange of material and technology to Russia, including the technology of materials to build the atomic bomb. The United States was set up as a testing ground for the New World Order, for the Jew World Order. This background information was intended as an introduction for the reader to the multifaceted Gnostic religion and the One World Government conspiracy that it's married to. You will now learn that these basic ingredients are the same for the various Gnostic hierarchical religions. They just have a different flavor to them. They operate off the same principles. There is even a book of how to start your own religion. As you progress through this book, Be Wise as Serpents, you'll learn how they cooperate and function together. What we have been viewing as separate independent religious groups are actually at the very top working together. This chapter is meant to be a good tool to enable the reader to see that those basic ingredients of Gnosticism make up all the Gnostic religions, and that the Jehovah Witnesses, the Nazis, the Mormons, the Masons, Wicca, etc., are simply different flavors of the same thing. If you want a Muslim flavor, be a Sufi. If you want a Jewish flavor, join a New Age Jewish synagogue. If you want a Buddhist flavor, join Nichiren Shoshu or Lamaism. If you want an American Indian flavor, join the Earth Circle or the Bear Tribe Medicine Circle. If you want a Christian flavor, join the Moravians or Jehovah Witnesses or the LDS Church or the I Am. The Gnostic New Age movement has other flavors too: Egyptian, Aryan, witchcraft, sun worship, Satan worship, and New Thought. This author has drawn a diagram to show the reader his choice of Gnostic poisons. What flavor do you want? He says, let's say your religious tastes are like the Neapolitan ice cream, a combination of three. Lover, there are groups to accommodate you. For example, Anna Lee Scarron has an offshoot from Mormonism, which is a small metaphysical religion. In 1948, she published Ye Are Gods, another of the many Mormon offshoots called the Aryan Christian Church, combines the philosophies of Mormonism and Nazism. They use the Hitler salute and the swastika. Let me stop right there. The Hitler salute is how we used to salute our flag in America. And the swastika is not an evil sign whatsoever. It's pathetic, you know. But, you know, I can see that in this book that he keeps wanting to demonize Hitler, thus demonizing Germany, of course, right? Basic ingredients to create a Gnostic religion: hidden knowledge, a hierarchy, generally divided in three basic tiers: the general initiates, the elect, and the enlightened topped 1, 2, or 3 leaders. The higher one goes up the hierarchy, the more knowledge is dished out. Let's pause. Now, that's what college is. I mentioned that before. Let's pause and define esoteric. Esoteric means intended to be understood by only a select small group. Exoteric means intended for the general consumption, for the general population, let's say. Ingredient one, the knowledge given is mystical and esoteric knowledge. A great emphasis is placed on secrecy. Its salvation rests on man controlling himself and working out his own destiny. Only initiates at special occult centers learn the power and symbols. The word gnosis means the ultimate knowledge transmitted by an elite hierarchy of initiates. The externalization of the hierarchy? Another trademark is that there are current cycles of cataclysms and an earthly paradise often called the Golden Age. Ingredient 2. The hierarchy has a ternary classification system. The Theosophical Society informs, okay, I'm going past this thing here, the reader of the Gnosis and Christianity. The practice common to all the genuine Gnostic cults was followed in having at least 3 degrees of membership or initiation. It was only in the highest degree that the deepest mysteries were orally communicated. Remember the last tip they gave us? That the deepest mysteries are only orally communicated to the very top leaders? In terms of their use of the ternary system, consider the following Gnostic religions. Catharism. Number one, you have the pure ones. Two, the initiates, and three, the masses. Jehovah Witnesses. Number three, you have the great crowd. Number two, the anointed. Number one, the faithful and wise servants, those actually leading the president or governing body. The Mormons. Three, the Aaronic priesthood. Number two, the Melchizedek priesthood. And number one, the top prophet and his presidency. The Nazis. Number three, the Aryan race. Number two, the Nazi party. And number one, the very top of the Nazi religion, the high priest Hitler, who was considered their god by some devoted Nazis. My. Okay. Lamaism. You know, the Dalai Lama who says he's God? Number one, the Dalai Lama, considered God, a reincarnated Buddha. Number two, the Lama priests, a.k.a. Tulkos. Number three, the mass of Tibetan believers. The Essenes, you've heard of them. The first were the perfect. The second were the brethren. And the third were the neophytes. So, what, you know what a neophyte means. It means you're new. You're a new convert. Convert, an initiate. Then you become the brethren, and then you become the perfect. That's the Essenes. You've heard of them in the Bible. Church universal and triumphant. Number one, the messenger. 2A, permanent staff. 2B, temporary staff. 3A, community member. 3B, keeper of the flame. 3C, Pearl's Reader. Many have asked this author to do the leaders of the cults know what is going on? Yes, they have been orally, emphasis on that word orally, told exactly what's happening. The leaders of the New Age, the Jehovah Witnesses, and the LDS Church know what they are up to and what their roles are creating a one-world government or a Jewish-dominated one-world government, ladies and gentlemen. That is the method that Gnosticism uses. The very top prophet or illuminated master is informed orally. Illumination for any Gnostic group comes from superhuman knowledge. New Age leaders almost always claim they are channeling. You know that's true. There is an evolving dualistic fight of lightness and darkness found in the Hindu Vedas, the old Germanic legends, the Nordic sagas, and the Jehovah Witnesses myth that Jehovah is struggling to vindicate himself to Satan, when in fact, Jehovah is Satan. Like C.T. Russell, founder of the Watchtower Society, the Gnostics often see the sun as a primary sacred symbol. The Hakenkreuz swastika of the Nazis was a sun wheel. The swastika was a frequently used Masonic symbol until Hitler. Since Hitler, the Masons haven't been using it. It is also called the Gamma Cross and has been used for many centuries. You see, let me explain something, though. You know Luke Skywalker, the sun walks across the sky, right? In the middle of the day, it's at the middle, and at the end of the day, it's in the west, right? In the beginning of the day, it's in the east, right? So that's what it's all about. And there's nothing evil about that. And the Gamma Cross, is there something evil about a cross? I guess there are people that say, well, the cross is from Egypt, and, you know, but that's the one that they put a circle on the top, and it's a different cross than the regular cross. Now, the double cross is another thing altogether. But it says it's also called the Gamma Cross and has been used for many centuries. The Jewish Gnostic groups have tended to exalt the moon, also the planets and stars, while Aryan groups from India, Iran, and Germany tend to exalt the sun. One of the better summaries of Gnosticism and how Gnostic religion has come down to the ages through the ages to us today is given by the Theosophical Society. From the time of the closing of the Neoplatonic and Gnostic schools to the last quarter of the 19th century, save for a few alchemists, Kabbalists, Rosicrucians, occultly instructed Masons, and Christian mystics, theosophy was unknown in the Western world. Now listen. Does Paul not talk about the mysteries? Yes, he does. See, there are people known as Christian mystics, as it says right here. The mysteries. We know the mysteries are Freemasonry, the ancient mysteries, the mystery schools. Very revealing, that kind of talk. Theosophy was unknown in the Western world. Before then, it was known and studied in various forms by the Platonists, the Pythagoreans, the Egyptians, and the Chaldeans. While in India and China, it has been preserved down to the ages in unbroken continuity. It is the wisdom of the Upanishads and the Vedas, the very heart of Hinduism, Taoism, and Islam. To realize what's being said here is eye-opening. The Rosicrucians and occult Masons have preserved Gnostic theosophy, which is the very heart of Hinduism, Taoism, and Islam. The Gnostic religions are often called pagan. Let me stop right there. Remember that when we were reading the Catholic book, it was talking about how the Jews were mixing Gnostic religions with Christianity. You see how this all ties together? See, we're learning a lot of things that are important, and I really believe that we're right on course, right over the targets, and we're learning. Of course, we know that the Jew is at the bottom of it all. But it's very interesting that you've linked them up with pagan. Now, and this is Babylonian, because everything Babylonian, when Babylon, the Babylonian church, is mixed with Christianity, it's called the Catholic Church. When the Jews that were caught with us and brought to Babylon captured, they created the Talmud, which is those works that are the traditions of men. They're not anything to, it's not even a religion. It's pagan, though. Now, if you want to say paganism is a religion, I suppose you could, but there's much more to the Talmud, the books of the Talmud, than, I think there's 27 books, if I'm right. I'm not sure. I can't remember. But paganism is a big part of Talmudism. And paganism is a big part of Babylon. And paganism is a big part of Satanism. And paganism, obviously, the Gnostic religions are often called pagan, you see? This pagan worship is often the exoteric cover that the first levels are initiated to. The highest level is often the real esoteric worship and often involves direct Luciferian and satanic worship. In other words, the sun worship of the Masons and of other groups is a fig leaf for the worship by the highest levels of the divine serpent Satan. Very, very interesting, and you can see that now, I believe it was called Devils Making Hybrids, the Rabbit Hole Radio Show, will link up to this message. So if you wanted to get some deeper insight, you'll find out, like I said, that the Jews were mixing. This was from the Catholic book, Maurice Pinet's book. And the Jews, back in those times, a long time ago, were mixing Gnostic religions with Christianity. In other words, devils making hybrids. Gnostic religions use symbols and rituals. The Jehovah Witnesses have formed their own new rituals and their own new symbols, but they have retained the magical use of the word Jehovah, which has been in use for centuries. Remember that this is the devil, another name of the devil. This is not Yahweh, but what it is it's another hybrid. And it was made by using Yahweh's name, the Tetragrammaton, and mixing it with Adonai, the Lord. That's how the name Jehovah came out. Jehovah is the devil. Another name for the devil, and has nothing to do with Yahweh other than they mixed his name with the Lord, Adonai. So, that is something that we learned that was an important thing, because the Masons used the name Jehovah, but they wouldn't say the name Jesus, They have said the name Yahweh a couple of times, but it's rare. They do have a god called Jabulon, where they mix three different gods. The bull, the sun god On, and who knows, maybe Jah is supposed to be Yahweh's name, a part of Yahweh's name. You see, when you mix something with something else, it's not, you can't say, well, that's Yahweh. No. If you mix something and come out with the name Jehovah, you can, but Yahweh's Tetragrammaton was used to make this new concoction. That's not Yahweh. That's something that's been poisoned, something that's been mixed, something that's been adulterated. That's not Yahweh's name. So just want you to understand that. So the Watchtower Society has followed the very popular school of Gnosticism, which follows the ideas of Valentius. This school teaches, and as a matter of fact, Valentius was mentioned in Maurice Pinet's book. This school teaches the matter is more evil than good, that matter is more evil than good, and that all matter will be destroyed by fire. For instance, this pattern of thought is seen in the refusal of the Watchtower Society to accept sex as a natural process and to view it as an evil to be tolerated. Listen to a professed Gnostic. Here's a quote. Humanity reaches forward to a spiritual consummation when the whole earth will be peopled with a race of men fully conscious of their godlike natures and powers. And sin, sickness, and death will have been banished for the remaining period of the earth's cosmic cycle. It almost sounds like something out of the Watchtower magazine. The Watchtower magazine has even used phraseology that a new race was to inhabit the new system. In the Golden Age, I will add. It's very interesting, folks. We're really connecting dots here. The Gnostics believe they have a deeper form of Christianity. Then they generally take this further, contending that they have the root teaching for the ancient scriptures of other religions. They indeed have the root teaching of religion, but not of the Christian faith. In the first book of the Hebrew scriptures is the story of the perfect Garden of Eden. This perfect garden environment shows that originally God had established order. Some readers may not believe the Genesis account. Even so, by continuing to read this chapter, you will understand an alternative to the Jew world order's Gnosticism and why many Christians contend their faith in God is the opposite of religion. This is important not only for those seeking answers, but also to understand why the Christianity that Christ taught is being singled out for destruction. Let me stop that right there. Listen carefully. This is important not only for those seeking answers, but also to understand why the Christianity that Christ taught is being singled out for destruction. See, that's the exclusivity. That's what he taught in the, you know how they're saying that everything's anti-Jewishism in the newer part of the Testament? And you see, but they don't have any problem with the Apostle Paul. Did you notice that the Apostle Paul is not very anti-Jewistic at all? The only things I can really remember him saying is, you know, beware of the fables of the Jews. Very little of Paul's work is anti-Jewistic. You know, and there it is, right? Beware of the fables of the Jews, right? So when I say that Paul says to the Jew first and then to the Gentile, they say, oh, no, that means to the Judean first and then to the other people, right? And so basically I say to him, no, that's not the way it is. He means to the Jew first and to the Gentile. So then if that principle was true, then when he says beware of the fables of the Jews, then he means beware of the fables of the Judeans, not of the Jews. You see what I'm saying to you? You understand the point there? See, sometimes, even though the word Jew is not supposed to be there and is there to confuse people, the Jews are these race-mixed mob of people. And they have a lot of fables. And we see that we should beware of the fables. Paul can't always lie. He can't always be teaching things. He has to teach some truth throughout that whole thing. It's just like these Jewish truth tellers today. If they went out and they put all falsehoods there, you wouldn't believe them. But if they put enough truth to where you say, oh, I see that this is a truth teller, then you believe everything. You see, you're swallowing the whole camel. And yet you're straining at a gnat about the word Jew. To the Jew first and then to the Gentile. Now, both of those words are bogus. But Paul means the literal race-mixed mob of people called the Jews today. No, he's not meaning to the Judean first, because what about the tribe of Benjamin? See, if you're saying the Gentiles means the 10 tribes of Israel, which some people try to say, right? So it's to the Jew first, to the Judean first, to the tribe of Judah first, then to the 10 tribes of Israel. Well, where's Benjamin in all of that? See? It's not that confusing, but people are trying to confuse you. And it's funny that the Apostle Paul is the one that confuses people the most, and yet he'll tell you, to make sure that you stay in the simplicity of Christ. It's amazing stuff, folks. It really is. So, of course, the Gnostics, it said here, the Gnostics believe that they have a deeper form of Christianity. And, of course, that's what the Jew would do. He'd say, well, we're going to start a new Christian religion and we're going to mix it with Gnosticism. And we'll just tell them that we have a deeper form than you have. So, think about the statement. This is important not only for those seeking answers, but also to understand why Christianity that Christ taught, his gospel, is being singled out for destruction. Not the Apostle Paul's gospel, though. The Christianity that Christ taught. From the time man left the garden environment of order, he has been trying to create a new world order. By the use of religion, he has tried to patch up the wild world and to rearrange, to repair, to reform his polluted, disordered world. This condition of the world testifies that religion has failed. But religion was never meant to be the tool to reorder the world. In the Garden of Eden, Jesus Christ was promised to Adam and Eve as God's own method of reconciling himself back to mankind. Christ was the hope of the... Now, he says Hebrew prophets, but that's the Jews aren't Hebrews. Poor Fritz Springmeier, he is a very intelligent fellow, and I think that he doesn't know that the Jews aren't the Hebrews, and he doesn't know that the white people are the actual Israelites of the Bible. He doesn't know about two seed line, obviously, or something's wrong somewhere. That's all I have to say. So, listen to this. Christ was the hope of the Hebrew prophets and the center of their faith in God. The mystery of God, Jesus Christ, was sent to man as God's way of allowing those people to search for him and get to know him. Religion is supposedly a search for God, but in reality, the priesthoods are not honestly looking for God to reveal himself. How often do they speak of a need for atonement? But they are looking for techniques they can develop to sell to the masses. Religion continues for various reasons, many of them selfish. Yes, you can see that as I have read this Catholic book, from Maurice Pinet, how they glorify man and glorify the church and glorify anything but Jesus Christ and the Father in heaven. You see, because it's a selfish thing, because it's not real Christianity. And they're using it as a weapon on the people. So it says, in reality, they have misunderstood the Christian message. They reinterpret in the view of their religious message. All religions are seeking gods in their own strength and becoming proud of their findings. So, we stop there. And that's where we'll start next week. We're on page 139. It's pretty amazing to me. I'm very excited about what we're learning. I really am. And I think this is going to help clear up a lot of things that you've noticed in life, a lot of questions you had about churches you've attended, and so on and so forth. I think if you think back like I have, you'll see the evidence of these things within the churches that you attended. Isn't that interesting? Because I was told, as I told you a long time ago, I was told that God is both male and female by this so-called pastor. His last name was, I'm trying to think, and it's a bad name, wrong. His last name was Satrapi, and you know what the word satrape, right? You've heard of it. And he told me that God was both male and female, and I saw his ears were very pointed, and he was not very Anglo-Saxon looking. a very odd-looking fellow. But you see, you don't realize all these things. I mean, I realized that then, and I told him that God is not both male and female. He's a man. He's male. He's not a man, but he was at a time. He was in the flesh. But he is the patriarch. He's the father. He's not a mother. So this is just very interesting stuff, folks. I hope you're enjoying this, and I hope you're learning. And you've been listening to Saxon's Creed Radio Show. I'm David James, and until next time, study to show thyself approved.